with that, I think if Patrick, if you just want to start us off and leave with some of your questions or topics, and then we can join in with any questions or with insight and go from there.
Yeah, sure. Well, given the people on the call here, I'm not sure if I feel very expert. There's a lot of great experience here on the line. But I think any discussion about marketing in and around publishing probably starts with what our needs are, what our objectives are, maybe what the pain points are. And when I used to meet with people and talk about their marketing needs, the first part of our conversation all centered around that. So as you think about what your marketing needs are, what your issues are, what your concerns are, what your pain points are, maybe we could just throw a few of those out. And then as we identify a couple of them, maybe we can walk through two or three scenarios on finding solutions for those in and around the space of marketing. But if nobody has any pain points, that will make it easy. So when I think about pain points, I think about what is it we need. So for example, as a publisher, we might need more customers, more paying customers, either on a subscription level or on an advertising level. We might need to increase our brand or our distribution network. We might need to find ways to
has arrived.
You know.
So I'd say, Patrick, a couple things just talking about in the customers area for membership. I think we need two different kinds of members. Well, maybe three if you include students as well. I think we need to find some more casual members that are going to be paying productive members of the association but get benefit from the different contacts and networking and conferences that we have. But I think we also need to find some people who are more likely to be the leaders and the ones who really will see the vision of the association and will dive in and try to be a committee chair and just really take that and run with it. So there's those two, as well as the up-and-coming student-type memberships that we need to try to attract.
Okay, so you're speaking specifically for LDSPPA. Okay.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I guess we're talking more generally to just marketing in general as well.
Well, whatever the need is, if the need happens to be centered around LDSPPA, that's a good place to start talking. So in that space, I suppose we probably have reached out in the past through networking and stuff like that. Have we purchased any type of membership lists or tried to find broad-based data that we could reach out to what you're calling casual members or and in that larger net, capture some leaders in the industry?
I don't believe we have.
Yeah, okay.
So what are some good resources for a list that you can target by profession or by geography?
Well, the great thing about lists is you can buy whatever you got the money to purchase it for. But it really comes down to how much is each individual lead worth to you. So in our case here, there's a little bit of money that might flow back to us in forms of dues and stuff. But there's probably a real limited budget for reaching out. But I would, you know, with almost any mailing house, you can get whatever list you would want to get in terms of categories of professionals. If you wanted to focus in on, you know, editors or freelance writers or members of an association that are already joined, you could buy that list, that type of a thing too. But that's one that kind of jumps very quickly to a solution. And generally, when I'm thinking about an approach to marketing, we think about, okay, itemize those pain points. And you did a good job of talking about two of them. We need people. We need members of this organization. Of two different segments, some that'll be strong leaders and some that'll just benefit from that. And once you identify pain points, then you can start outlining objectives associated with whatever your marketing plan is. So if we've got clear on what the pain points were, then we could start talking about, okay, what are the objectives? Well, the objectives would be to recruit new people and get people who will get engaged and get involved and will benefit from the organization and maybe step up and serve on the board or speak at a conference or something like that. And then as we itemize all those different objectives, and there are going to be multiple ones, then we can start talking about, okay, if that's what we really want our marketing to do, what are the ways that we go about making that happen? So then we drill down a little bit more in the audience to understand their motivations, and then we can actually reach out to different channels that swim in those same swim lanes that those people live in. And then we can build out messages that meet the needs of those individuals we're trying to reach at the end of the audience. And then at that point, kind of build a tactical marketing plan around that to where we're putting the action to it so that when it's all said and done, we can then measure the results against some real metrics that we've established up front that show us what success looks like and then evaluate. You know, so that's kind of a common circle of activity that centers in and around any kind of marketing challenge. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, so maybe if you could just concisely say the steps. So pain points, figure out your pain points, then figure out what your objectives are in each of those pain points. And then I think there's a step before setting goals.
Yeah, so once you have objectives, you should identify measurable metrics on what that success looks like. So let's say that one of your pain points is you don't have enough customers, and one of your objectives through your marketing outreach would be to get more referrals. And so what's a great metric that matches with more referrals? Well, it could be, you know, I want to get 10 referrals a month, or I want to get one referral from each customer, or I want to, you know, come out of this Chamber of Commerce meeting with, you know, three new people that I've met that can then be referrals type of thing. But something that's measurable that you can say, okay, this is what success looks like, even if it's in a phased approach.
Okay, so then that's metrics, and after metrics, is that when you go to the plans?
No, I think then you drill down to audience. So if we know what we want to do, we know what our pain is, and we know what we want to do, and we kind of know what success in that space will look like, then who are we going to be talking to? What's the audience? You know, if they are, let's say we were talking about a product that's consumable. How do they consume that product? Why do they consume it? How frequently do they consume it? When do they consume it? Do they consume it in conjunction with other products, for example? You know, try to get into the mind of what that consumer or that audience would do so that once you have that, and I actually left one out as I was talking earlier, then you key in on the message that you want to share with that audience. And all of this is done before we go down to the channel, you know. So once we understand the audience and kind of what their motivations are and their needs, then we think, how do we communicate with them? Well, if the audience was children, when we would communicate with them in a way that would make sense to those children. And we would get key messages through that communication that would spike their motivation, you know, get their attention type of thing. And you see it all the time with media messages out there, you know. And then once the message is clear, then you choose the channel of distribution. So when we were talking earlier, Brad, about, well, we need more people, so how do we go about doing that? There's a real temptation to want to jump right to the solution. But if we jump to the solution too early, we may find that we're prescribing a solution for a problem that we don't really understand. You know what I mean? So that's why a doctor is supposed to ask lots and lots of questions before they prescribe some kind of a medical solution. But once we do have those itemized things listed, you know, pain points, objectives, clear metrics on what success looks like, audience understanding, and even maybe even segment that audience like you talked about, you know, we want casual members as well as leaders, then clarify what the message is. Then we start thinking, okay, now how do we reach that audience? What are the channels we're using to reach that audience? So you know, if we're going to go social, how are we going to reach them? What type of social channels? Or if we're going to go through traditional ways or mailing lists like you suggested, you know.
Has arrived.
Those are all different ways that people can reach out through a channel.
Oh. And then after channel, is that when you start evaluating what your...
Once you've got the channel, then you put together a very tactical plan to put the actions to it. So if in your publishing group you wanted to acquire a bunch of extra...
Can I interrupt and just ask who just joined the call? We just had a new one? Okay. And this is Steve Piersanti again. Caroline, it's immediately obvious why you wanted Patrick to lead this discussion. I'm hoping that you're taking notes so that...
I am.
Because so there's a lot of great content here that we'll want to share in a follow-up.
Yep, I'm taking notes. I'll be sure to share them.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you, Patrick.
No problem. I actually turned on a recorder as well, too. I don't know if it'll work, but we'll see.
Okay.
But you were asking, so in terms of the going down to the channel, you've identified all the big pieces here. Now you're going to put all the action to it so that you've got a real marketing plan to roll out to that. And the components of that marketing plan include... clearly identified objectives, clearly identified metrics that show us what success looks like, a really clear understanding of our audience and their motivations, and a clear understanding of the message we want to share with them, and then finally how we want to get that message down to them, whether or not we're going to send it through an airplane or a car or an Uber driver or whatever it is. And then when it's all said and done, it's all conceptual at this point. It's all been matter unorganized, and now we're going to organize it into a plan, and that's where the tactical actions take place. So those actions might be, okay, we're going to establish this social channel, and we're going to push through these messages, and we're going to do it at this time frame when it intersects in a way that really meets the needs of the audience, for example, around a holiday or something like that. So those are just basic elements that you can apply to any type of business if you're rolling out elements of marketing within that business. It could be conceptual things. It could be building the LDS PPA, or it could be building a publishing company with increased authors, or it could be selling widgets, you know.
So what might be kind of helpful is to actually take a sample and kind of go through these steps for some actual practical problem. And I'm fine if it's somebody else's pain points and not these LDS PPA specific ones, maybe a more publishing general one. But I think that would be a helpful practice for me.
Yeah, well, who's got something they want to throw out?
Could you repeat that?
Is there anybody who has any place they want to start with their own individual publishing business? If there is, we can start with that. If not, I can throw out an idea, a suggestion.
I actually have a question that might, I think it might help me kind of clarify my thoughts a little bit. Patrick, would you mind defining what... like a pain point, like how you define that for...
Yeah, sure.
Those that's not in marketing.
Yeah, sure. So let's say I once bought a direct mail advertising franchise, and I purchased it on the cheap because it didn't have any customers. All it had was an opportunity. And my biggest pain was I didn't have any paying customers. And my paying customers would be advertisers. So I had the mechanism to direct mail to people in a very targeted way, but I didn't have any customers. So my major pain point is, how can I generate customers fast, and that would be not just one-time customers, but repeat customers. So that's a pain point. So I didn't have enough money. I needed money to pay my overhead. That was my identified pain point, probably my first issue there. Now, how you go about solving that requires you to think through, okay, well, what do you want to accomplish through that, you know? And sometimes you think about when your pain points, you see them within a context. Okay, so the context is, in my situation is, I didn't have any other employees. So I was limited to my own time and efforts and talents. So I had to find solutions. I had to identify objectives and find solutions within the context that I could work within. And so in that little scenario, I determined, okay, how am I going to spend my time? First of all, what do I want to do? What do I want to accomplish? And then how am I going to spend my time to alleviate that pain point? In other words, get some customers. If that makes sense. So if you were an editor without enough customers, one of those would be, my pain point is, I can edit. I want to make money editing. I don't have any clients, or I don't have enough clients.
Okay, I see. So would you say that a pain point is pretty much always just needing more customers, or is that just the strongest example?
Well, it could be. One time I took on a consulting job to do something I'd never done. The pain for me was I don't feel competent, but people had hired me to do something that I didn't have enough. So my pain point was I need to come up to speed very fast. Now that was more of a development issue than a marketing issue for me, but that was a real pain point in that moment.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
I suppose anything that causes pain, you know, can kind of be described as that. And sometimes, believe it or not, pain point could be too many customers. Too many of...
Has arrived.
It could be too many customers that are not the right kind. Welcome back.
So I guess we're talking about if there's a specific. I think maybe Patrick, you're going to go through an example of walking through this process of what your pain point is, and then how you would kind of break it down step by step to eventually alleviate that and turn the pain point into a business opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, if we let's say absent of a real example, let me throw one out of one that I've experienced. Okay. I once had a little magazine publishing business, and we wanted to take advantage of the Olympics that were coming to Salt Lake City. But we didn't know how to put together an Olympic magazine, and we didn't know how to make an Olympic magazine profitable. It seemed like it would be an easy thing. So I started off by thinking, okay, I want to do this, but I don't know how to do it. So my pain point is I need knowledge, you know. So I set down some objectives, and the objectives would be, you know, I want to publish a magazine that makes me money, that's good for the community, that's good for the event, the Olympic event. So those were my objectives, and then I put metrics associated with those objectives that matched with my business model. So I got to make, you know, enough to where it's the profitability is worth my time investment, things like that. And then I started calling around to other magazine publishers who had hosted the Olympics. And I found out that not one of them had ever been successful in putting together an Olympic-oriented magazine when the Olympics were in town with them. And I thought, well, why not? And so I started asking what went wrong, and they gave me a whole long list of things that went wrong, but they didn't know how to do it right. And so I kind of tried to then reverse engineer it based on what I was getting. So basically, you're asking a lot of questions to get information, and you're seeing if the information you're getting will help you find a pathway forward to meet your objective. In that case, for me to come up with a way to publish a successful Olympic magazine. And through that process, we started to identify two or three really big points, clog points that weren't working for these people. One of them was they didn't start early enough. because to bring in national advertisers and to bring local advertisers on, we had to put this thing together 18 months in advance of the Olympics arriving. We had to have editorial concepts down. We had to have advertising materials put together. We had to start selling them, and we had to deadline it. You know, what we chose to do is deadline it 9 months before the Olympics even arrived. And then we had to come up. The distribution wasn't the problem. It was putting the whole thing together with advance notice to get the advertisers on board before the event came on. And so I don't know if this is a very good example, but in the long run, after identifying what those objectives were, helping us understand what the measurable metrics were, understanding who the audiences were, and there were multiple audiences in this case, the advertising audience, the readership audience when it would come in town. So we had to create an entire new distribution to people who would be coming to the city right before the Olympics, none of whom we knew who they would be. So we had to find a free distribution method. And then we had to figure out, okay, how are we going to push these messages out in terms of advertising messages and stuff like that? And it worked out.
So Patrick, really quickly, on the audience thing, this is something that we struggle with sometimes as a publisher because we're pretty varied in what we do. And so how did you identify the audience, or how do you identify what the audience is and where they are for a particular publishing project?
So I have to confess that consumer magazine publishing, in my mind, is a lot easier than publishing of materials that are read for intellectual benefit or for education. I don't have as much experience in that space, but for me, I thought my main objective was I wanted to sell advertising. I wanted to sell a lot of it. And if I do that, then I need to get as many eyeballs reading those magazines. So I thought, okay, what are the people who are going to come to the Olympics going to want to read? What will they want to read? What format will they want to see it in? And so it was easy for me to identify an editorial calendar that would meet the needs of the person who'd flown into Salt Lake for 2.5 weeks, a kind of an upscale audience, someone with lots of money who could go to the venues, someone who could stay at the nicest hotels, see all the nice restaurants, things like that. So one audience was centered in and around the editorial. The secondary audience was the people who wanted that audience, you know, who wanted those upscale readers. And of course, that was the national and regional advertisers that normally we wouldn't be able to have access to because we had too small of a distribution footprint for our books. I don't really know how to go about doing it. Let's say that you've got a book that you're going to publish on a certain topic. Then that audience becomes much more niche, much more targeted, and the revenue streams for the type of publishing, I think, Brad, that you're talking about, center around sales of the product in a retail environment or online sales. Again, this is a space that you guys have a lot of expertise in. I don't. But if I was thinking in that space, I would think, who is consuming, who can potentially consume this product, and why would they consume it, and how would they consume it, and is there a better way for them to receive it than the way I'm creating it and sharing it, and what's the motivation for them to consume it, and how can I leverage that motivation? Can I package it with something else, for example, you know?
Are there any tools that you're aware of to find out where an existing audience is located? So where are they congregating, online or in person?
So there are a lot of analytics tools today that that show where there are big data tools that show how large crowds are consuming and thinking and making decisions. And then from that big data, there are more clustered groups that you can get information on in terms of what the patterns are for different types of segments of audience. But if you're wanting to identify specific people, like folks who have bought historical fiction or something like that, that generally boils down to consumer lists or customer lists. But that's not an area of much expertise on my end, quite honestly. But the only thing I've really done with any consistency that's worked is just be very inquisitive and find information, you know, ask the kind of questions you're asking and be relentless about asking it until you become knowledgeable enough to where you're asking the right questions. And then over time, you actually become one of the people who knows more about it than others. And then you've had more confidence as you're moving forward in those spaces.
Thanks. That's really helpful, Patrick.
Yeah, I feel a bit unqualified to answer some of those specific questions in that space. I mentioned to someone the other day, I have not been in publishing for well over a decade. So, and you know how fast that world has changed. So.
But I think the principles are consistent, though. I mean, everybody's looking for their audience, and everybody has to deal with pain points. And so I think these are great just general practices and great thought processes to go through.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there is a lot of consistency there, too.
Yeah, I think maybe the channel of distribution, the tactical plans might be a little different. But I think all those first exercises that you go through, I think those are probably consistent among multiple different industries, and certainly between magazines and book publishing.
Yeah, and I will say that even in my current work right now, for the last decade working in church history, when we're thinking about a product, a church history product for members worldwide or for a subset of members like patriarchs or ecclesiastical leaders, we go through the same process. It's just basic product management where we really, really try to understand the audience, try to understand their motivations, try to understand their interactions, and we do a lot of testing. As you create products, you do a lot of testing to see what version of that product is working.
So do you actually do split testing, A-B testing on the products that you develop?
We do for our web and products like that. And it's very helpful. LDS.org does it all the time. We've done it on some of our products. Again, we're a subset of LDS.org, but I mean, right now we just wrote some historic site guides for the new priesthood restoration site in Harmony, Pennsylvania, and we've adapted them into an online version for the missionaries to use, and we're taking those down next month to test to see if that's working. And we won't necessarily do A-B testing down there, but we're going to do iteration testing. So whatever level we have, we're going to see how it works for a week and get feedback. The new museum that we opened up this last month, a multi-million dollar renovation, we've already done research on that within the last 30 days and have a huge punch list of things we're going to change about it. You know, not big tweaks, but big enough tweaks to hopefully make a difference. And in product...
Can you say more about what you mean by iteration testing and how you're doing this research?
So in our world, as we create content, we want to make sure that that content is relevant, meaningful, and has a certain type of effect on the person who's receiving it. So, and content is fairly subjective. I mean, history isn't, but the way you share it can be subjective. You know, the words you use and the context it's shared in, and the medium it's shared with. So, as we put together these historic site guides, for example, we put them together thinking about, you know, instructional learning, and we think it's going to work out, but we're not sure how it's going to be received. And so we come to a certain version of it, and we say, okay, now let's see what this version looks like, and is it working? And as we do that, we get feedback, and then we make another version of it. So we are always changing or trying to evolve that product to the point that it makes the most sense for the person who's using it. And some things.
And what tools, Patrick, are you using primarily to gather the feedback?
In this case, we'll have people on the ground who actually we do a lot of observation, So I know that doesn't sound very sexy, but standing around watching people go through an exhibit or watching missionaries interact with patrons who are coming to the Priest of Restoration site is really insightful, and it doesn't cost much. Other types of tools that we've used in the past for historical products have been, you know, focus groups. Right now I'm sending out, just today we sent out a big 60-question web survey to our internal church history catalog users to get their feedback on how the current version of the church history catalog is working for them. And we asked a series of questions, 30 questions asked two different ways, so that we can mesh the answers together and try to get insight into how they're answering those questions. So, you know, so in one case it's face-to-face observation. In another case it's email surveys. Another case it could be A/B testing, and sometimes it's just.
And what kind of responsiveness on the surveys and focus groups do you have? I'm always concerned that you're going to get just the people who are either seriously bugged or you're not really going to get the general sense with some of these volunteer type things.
Yeah, you're right about that, Brad, and it's particularly challenging for members of the church when the church is asking the questions. I mean, nobody wants to be too open on something like that.
Yeah.
But I think any data is better than no data. And so over the years, we've asked questions and we realize that there's just a percentage of you might get the squeaky wheels or something like that. But again, almost any data is better than no data. But you have to always balance what you're getting back with what the market is allowing you to move as a product. We don't have that benefit as a church. You know, I don't have sales necessarily, unless it's the Joseph Smith papers or other things, that I can balance my feedback against the market. But you do. And that's a very, very valuable tool to be able to have. So if you got a product that's selling like hotcakes, but your product ideation is telling you, you know, people don't like it, well, there's a disconnect there, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, one thing we're finding is that we at the church want to move more towards big data, because big data will give us an insight on what people are doing without the names and the numbers associated, without the names of the people associated with it. And we feel like that will be much more accurate than a survey we would send out to active members of the church who are going to say, what do you think about this product? That's great. You know, the church created it. I've got a testimony. I love it. You know?
So what would be some examples of pain points that you're trying to fit with in the big data, trying to solve through big data analysis?
Well, we haven't done a lot of it, but we're going to do some of it next year. So you're speaking to someone who's a bit of a novice in this space, who's learning. But isn't that how it is with everything? It moves so fast, you know? But particularly, we're very interested to find out how people consume church history and how they want to consume it. So traditionally, we've got these bright guys like Matt Godfrey who will write a 200-page essay with every jot and tittle in it, and it's fantastic stuff if that's the way you're built. But for most of us, we're not going to consume something like that. So the question is, should that be consumed in a 3-minute video? Should it be consumed into a 150-page book? Is it better consumed in little vignettes that are written serially in a church magazine? Or is it better to put on passion plays? I mean, these are all the kind of questions you would ask. And so we want to find if you find out in big data, how are people consuming other things? You know, well, most people get their news through a BuzzFeed kind of a format today, we find. Well, if that's the case, maybe that's a method by which we would share church history. But you can actually collect big data and from that determine segments of categories. So people who are LDS, for example, or people with families or whatever your segment you're looking for.
I have a question on the data. So, tying that to the church, like you were talking about, so are you using big data, as in we know that most people are consuming information through snippets, and so you're applying that general information of general society, and you're applying that to the church, or are you collecting big data just on the church? Church members?
Yeah, well, we haven't done much of it, but I will tell you that the people can... You can collect big data. Any business can start to collect big data, and they're doing it with much more frequency. And what you do with it and how you interpret it is kind of up to you. But the value of big data is that it doesn't have a name and a face to it. It's large trends. It's large psychographic and consumer-oriented trends. So, for example, you know when you read in the paper or on a magazine or on the news, it says, you know, more people in Utah search for ABC on the web than anywhere else. That information comes from big data, and it's like grabbing your arms and grabbing a big part of the ozone out there, and then extracting that information. And so, I feel like I'm very intrigued with it, and it's something that I'm going to pursue with some rigor next year with the limited resources that I have to try to better understand how people consume church history. And I think that most people in the publishing world or small businesses won't have a lot of access to big data right now, but I would assume that over time it's going to evolve itself to where people will be able to get snippets of that in their own space in a more functional way. You know, just like everything boils down.
Why wouldn't you have access? Can't you just Google a lot of these things and get it on the internet?
So Googling can give you, big data analysis is a little different than just Googling information, because what it does is it sees patterns of large swaths of people and where those patterns come. You ever seen those word clouds, Steve, that people put together? They kind of represent what's flowing out there in terms of trends. So that's somewhat similar to big data, but that's different than if you or I go on there and we do a Google search and we look at the first 10 or 15 responses. Those responses can be skewed by advertising purchases, by your own individual browser use, and they are skewed by that. So truth be told, we're getting the information through Google searches based on what a lot of people want us to receive, not just because it's objective information coming out there. But big data is much more objective because it's larger swaths of it. You know, it's like if we all go together to dinner and we decide to take a poll of who we think is going to win the presidential election, we'll come up with an answer. But it's not going to be statistically accurate. It might be statistically accurate for people in the publishing industry who belong to a certain church who live in a certain geographic area. Do you see what I mean? But it's not really statistically accurate for a larger swath of people.
How do you get around that?
Well, I think that my understanding is that by utilizing big data, and again, I'm just dangerous enough to I shouldn't even be talking about this. That's how little experience I have. But from my own research on this and the reports that I've seen and what I've been able to gather, I find it fascinating that you can find out what real trends are, for example, by a region, by a country, by a large demographic, and I think that's insightful, you know. One time I heard a historian tell me, he said, as America goes, so go the Mormons. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he says, as the trends of Americans in the United States, how they live, how they consume, how they think, that he felt like the general bulk of Mormons follow that trend. So in other words, there's a correlation between those two. And I think that when you can understand what's happening with big data, you can start making correlations to consumer choices, to trends in all kinds of businesses. And I think it gives you insight as a business owner.
Does anybody have any other questions?
I have a question, although it's probably way too late in this discussion to get into it. But the huge problem that we as a book publisher have is disintermediation from our customers. Because of Amazon, Amazon doesn't give you any, we're not able to actually connect with any customers individually. Because of bookstores, we as a book publisher, most of our sales, not all of it, but something like 70-80% of our sales, we're not in direct contact with the customer. There are gatekeepers in between us and the customers, and so what do we do then? That's our pain point.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's maybe a subject for another call at another time.
Yeah,
I should have something that's real quick and easy on that.
I don't think I do, but I will tell you that we had a very similar pain point for that on the Joseph Smith papers, and it was so strong because we were going through the Church Historians Press as the publisher, which we own. But we were leveraging marketing and distribution through a partner, Deseret Book, and that the limitations of our interaction with people like Amazon were brokered through the relationships that Deseret Book had, which were not always favorable to what we wanted. So there were these multiple layers. I think the big problem that you're talking about is probably a lot of publishers have that. It would be a great topic to brainstorm that. But that centers in and around strategy, publishing strategy in today's world. How do you break through that? What are options for that? Great question. I don't think I have any answers on that, but it would be a fascinating discussion.
Brad, do you have an answer to that?
You know, I think we face the same thing. Amazon does give you a little bit of resources in terms of information on it, although you have to pay for it, like with everything with Amazon. You can get information in terms of zip codes, areas where people are ordering your books. You can kind of see point of, as far as when you're doing promotion, you can see immediate upticks both in orders being placed and also in the Amazon rankings and use tools like NovelRank that actually track your Amazon rankings over time. So there are some tools we do that to try to approximate what you'd have if you were directly tied to the customer. But primarily what we've done is tried to promote to customers using traditional methods, including social media now, and then just kind of be agnostic in terms of where the customer is going to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that's kind of I think it's a big problem. We do. I will tell you, as far as a case study now, we have a series called Baby Lit that's pretty popular in the marketplace, and we've been building up an Instagram. We've really focused on Instagram on this, and we have seen an amazing response as we've done promotions to the followers on Instagram for this particular brand that we can move the needle. And we can make things happen in terms of sales, in terms of events, just by mobilizing that social media we had following that brand. Now with Barrett Kohler, that's probably more analogous to the authors that you have, because you have certain authors who have followings. And that's the case with some of our books as well. But as a publisher, we're trying to focus more on building brands that then we control instead of being subject to the whims of an author.
That's great that you've had success doing that, though. That's cool.
Yeah, it's been really. I don't think we've seen an ability to move the needle just as a publisher so much as when we had our own, now that we have our own social media following and a brand, as we've had before. I mean, every other time you're dependent on some other media channel to pick something up, or an author to use their contacts and their brand. But this has been kind of exciting to see.
Yeah, that is neat. Well, it looks like we've come to the witching hour.
This has been really helpful, Patrick. I absolutely appreciate your just the information. I've taken the good notes myself as well, and we'll have some good conversations internally. This has been great.
Well, I've enjoyed it, too.